but lost three straight games to end their series against the Canadiens. The second-seeded team, the New Jersey Devils, barely put up a fight against the Philadelphia Flyers, who now face Boston in the conference semifinals. The Canadiens skate against the defending champion Penguins. The favorites advanced in the Western Conference, with the exception of the Phoenix Coyotes, who fell to the more experienced Detroit. The Red Wings face off against the top-seeded San Jose Sharks tonight. Mike Pesca, NPR News.
China says it is pained by a ruling to strip the women's gymnastics team of its bronze medal from the 2000 Games, but respects the International Olympic Committee's decision. The IOC asked for the medal back yesterday after discovering that one of the athletes at the Sydney Games was too young to compete. China is pledging to prevent that from ever happening again. The bronze medal now belongs to the U.S. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
That's Sean Hayes in the new Broadway revival of Promises, Promises. You probably know him best as Jack from the TV series Will and Grace. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sean Hayes, and former poet laureate Robert Haas returns to talk about Walt Whitman. Haas edited a new collection of Whitman poems. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday, and an after hour till 3 p.m. featuring soups, sandwiches, salads, ice cream, and specialty coffees. Bevere offers Wi-Fi. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. On a recent visit to Afghanistan, President Barack Obama told U.S. troops there that they were there to help the Afghan people forge a hard-won peace. And it is very clear that in that effort, the neighboring country of Pakistan has a central role. It is also clear that the government of Pakistan has its own objectives with regard to its neighbor. We'll try to ask in this hour, Focus, some fairly basic questions about Pakistan and its politics, whether Pakistan is a reliable partner for the United States, whether the goals of the Pakistani leadership conflict at all with ours, whether we have reason to worry about the stability of the government of Pakistan. And our guest for this hour of Focus is Charles Kennedy. He is professor of political science at Wake Forest University. That's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And he's written a lot about South Asian political and governmental systems since the mid-70s and has done a lot of research in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India. He served as director of the American Institute of Pakistan Studies and also was the institute's secretary and has done a lot of teaching and research in the areas of political Islam, in U.S. foreign policy with respect to the Middle East and South Asia, particularly Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq. He's here visiting the campus and will be giving a talk talking about Afghanistan and Pakistan, the U.S. interests there. This is sponsored by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security at the U of I. Also Project Noor. It's a student-led initiative of the American Islamic Congress and also the Pakistani Graduate Students Association, all involved in bringing him here. His talk will be tonight at 7 at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus. It's free, open to the public, so anybody who is interested in attending can stop by. And also, of course, here for this hour as we talk, questions are welcome from listeners. We ask people to try to be brief if they can, but questions, comments are welcome. If you're in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number to call. We have a long-distance line or a toll-free line, if it would be long-distance call for you, 800-222-9455. And we also have email, so you can send along your questions that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, questions, comments are welcome. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And certainly, I guess one of the things that is obvious right up front, we said we thought it would be interesting to talk about Pakistan and current events there in Pakistani politics, and it's something that from time to time we try to do. Mm-hmm. But you cannot disentangle that from what's going on in India in Afghanistan, in much in the region. Let's talk about Pakistan and Afghanistan and what it is that, from a purely Pakistani point of view, you know, if you're only talking about, you know, their interests and their government, what are their interests in Afghanistan?
Well, that's a complicated question, and I'll just give a few bullet points with respect to this. One is that Pakistan, because of geographical considerations, historical considerations, and so forth, has an extraordinarily strong interest in what goes on in Afghanistan. If Afghanistan is unstable, Pakistan will suffer from that. And there has been a long contested relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan, going back even during the period of the British Raj in South Asia. So from Pakistan's perspective, one major issue is the issue of the continued unstable, largely unenforceable border between the two states. It's not really a border in many regards. It's really a contested border. The Durand Line, which was established in the late 19th century by the British, was never really accepted by the Pashtun people on both sides of this line. Pakistan in recent years has been of the view that this border should become hardened. This has been resisted, chronically has been resisted from Afghanistan, in part because of a consideration that that part of the Pashtun area was denied the state of Afghanistan by the British. So this long historical issue with the border is one issue. Another issue that is of chronic importance to Pakistan is whether Afghanistan comes under the influence of Pakistan's most dreaded foe, India. And this issue is very much joined now. India has established several consulates in Afghanistan. Pakistan sees these as ways to influence the Afghan government. President Karzai, up until fairly recently, was very supportive of India's role within Afghanistan. So Pakistan sees Afghanistan as being rife for Indian intervention and as a consequence, a challenge to Pakistani interests. And then just a third point, which I think is quite significant. From a Pakistani perspective, the war in Afghanistan has had very serious consequences for the stability of Pakistan itself. The suicide bombings and other sorts of disturbances that have occurred in Pakistan, to many in Pakistan, can be directly attributable to the war itself. So this is partially an internal problem, but it's perceived as being mostly an external problem, one that came about as a consequence of the war itself. I hope that addresses at least some of the concerns. Yeah.
Well, here, let me ask you some further questions. And again, this really gets very complicated very quickly. But one of the things that has really concerned the United States in regards to what it's doing in Afghanistan is the fact that we have this fuzzy, this very permeable border, and that Taliban, Afghan Taliban, can go over the border and live and get away from the United States forces on the Pakistani side of the border. So the United States, one of the things that it has really wanted for some time now, the government of Pakistan to do, is to move against Taliban on its side of the line. And apparently, recently, the government has actually been doing that. But what they're doing is that they're going against Pakistani Taliban and seem not real interested in going against Afghan Taliban. And I don't want to make too much out of a single quote, but I was reading here on the BBC website just recently, and there was an article here about Pakistan by Lise Doucette, who's written a lot and reported a lot on that region, and talking about the fact that she had recently been talking with the former head of the ISI, which is like the Pakistani CIA. That's the way it's sort of described. Hamid Ghul. And he said to her this, that I think is really interesting. He said, America is history. Karzai is history. The Taliban are the future. Which to me says a whole lot about both, about all of these things, about what their relation to the Taliban is, about the fact that we have two different Taliban to talk about, and what they want and what the United States wants, and how that all is all tangled up together.
Well, I think the first way to address this is to say that Hamid Ghul's views are extremist views with respect to this issue. Hamid Ghul was the director of the ISI during the period of Zia-ul-Haq, back in the days of the first war, the Soviet war. So I think in that sense they have to be discounted to some extent. This is not a widely held view within Pakistan, and certainly it's not a widely held view within Pakistan's military or, for that matter, the ISI. The ISI is often typified, as you did, as a CIA kind of organization. But actually, the ISI is part of the military. And in recent years, the last several years, the ISI has been very much a part of the military in the sense that individuals who are seconded to the ISI are seconded from the army and then, or the military in general, and then they come back to the army for the rest of their career. So this is very much a integral to the military itself. Now, with that said, the question of Pakistan's willingness to go after so-called Afghan Taliban. There's a couple issues here that arise. One is that Pakistan views the Taliban as being a constructed term, that there are various groups associated with the border regions. Some are targeting the war in Afghanistan directly. Some, particularly in recent years, months, have been targeting the Pakistani state. Pakistan is of the view, from a statal perspective, that those that are directly targeting Pakistan are more of a threat to the state than those that are engaged in the conflict across the border in Afghanistan. So I think a major consideration is that the first priority of Pakistan has been, and perhaps rightly, to counter the insurgents who are targeting the state, the Pakistan state. And in recent years, last year and a half, last 2 years or so, Pakistan has been subject to numerous attacks within Pakistan proper, some in the major metropolitan areas of the state, some that have been quite close to the vitals of the state, some that have targeted institutions of the state, and some that truly have threatened the integrity of the state. So in that sense, Pakistan sees these threats as being those that should be tackled first. I also want to point out that this period in which the United States was of the view and repeatedly emphasized that Pakistan was harboring or facilitating the Afghan Taliban has been muted significantly in the last several months by U.S. policymakers. Mm-hmm. So the position now of the United States, for the most part, is that Pakistan's activities that have targeted Waziristan and Bajur and of course, the Swat Valley are doing about as much as Pakistan can do. So the view that was prevalent, say, 6 months ago or so, that Pakistan was part of the problem, not part of the solution, has been reversed. And Pakistan is now being seen as being proactive with respect to its role in combating insurgents. I think that addresses some of the of the issues here.
Well, does that, and is that because Pakistan truly has been proactive, or because here in the United States we recognize that there's only so far we can push the government of Pakistan, and we truly do need them. We need their help if we're going to accomplish our goals in Afghanistan.
Well, both of these reasons, I think. I think Pakistan has been proactive. They've conducted very significant military maneuvers, exercises in Waziristan and Bajur and so forth, and of course in the Swat, which is in settled areas of Pakistan. Pakistan has suffered casualties from this, significant numbers of casualties. More generally, Pakistan has suffered more civilian deaths than were created by 9/11, certainly over the years. So Pakistan is very much joined in this conflict and has been really since the beginning. Now, it is also true, of course, that the United States is very dependent upon Pakistan for the conduct of this war. It's hard to imagine the United States and the ISAF being involved in the Afghan war without Pakistan's support. So there may be a consideration, almost certainly is a consideration in recent months, that putting pressure on Pakistan and stressing this idea that Pakistan's not doing enough is not getting the results that the United States intends for those messages to get, and is becoming increasingly or became increasingly an irritant to the Pakistani people and the government. So I think the United States has backed away from that kind of perception. My view is that Pakistan has always been proactive with respect to this issue. Its priorities have changed somewhat, and I think the level of their activity has been linked to the level of threat that is perceived within Pakistan, as evidenced by the very significant increase in violence within the state itself caused by the insurgents.
Our guest in this hour of Focus, Charles Kennedy. He's professor of political science at Wake Forest University, has written a lot about South Asian political and governmental systems since the mid-70s and done a lot of research in Pakistan, Bangladesh, India. He's here on the campus to talk about Pakistan and also the role of Pakistan in Afghanistan and connections between all of these countries and the United States. He'll be giving a talk tonight on the campus, and it's open to anybody who would like to attend. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You mentioned just a little earlier about the fact that there certainly have been times when I'm sure people in Pakistan were irritated with the pressure the United States was putting on them to assist in ways the United States was interested in dealing with the problem of Taliban and, you know, helping with our goals in Afghanistan. And I'm sure that there were times when people in Pakistan wanted to say, maybe they did say to the United States, you know, you need us a whole lot more than we need you. At the same time, I'm sure that there are people who would say, well, now, wait a minute. There are, in fact, things that the United States can do for Pakistan and ways in which you could argue, yes, Pakistan does need the United States. Can you make that argument? I mean, what is there for Pakistan? You know, we view this through our lens here in the United States. So what can Pakistan do for us in our policy? So what does Pakistan stand to gain from this relationship, though, with the United States?
I think to answer this question, one has to look at Pakistan's basic security dilemma, going back to the time of the independence of the state itself. Pakistan has been in this long-term contested relationship with India. And India, of course, is a much larger state. India has preponderating military capabilities, conventional military capabilities compared to Pakistan. It always has larger population, larger resources, and so forth. So Pakistan has adopted a strategy which has been consistent really virtually since the beginning of the state, to seek outside support as a counterweight to the Indian dominance. And the major source of this external support has been the United States. So Pakistan has sought support from the United States throughout. And one could look at various instances of this. Mm-hmm. So in a very general sense, that's what Pakistan continues to need from the United States is a sense of not wholly breaking this relationship if not alliance, at least a comity of interests. So with that said, however, your first remarks about irritation are very much there. The popularity of the United States as measured in public opinion polls has plummeted in Pakistan since the Afghan War began, and it continues to plummet. I think there's been a slight recovery, perhaps, in the last several months with regards to such public opinion data. But during the worst period of this, the popularity of the United States was lower in Pakistan than the popularity of India and Israel, which indicates that the United States is very, very unpopular.
Yeah.
And a lot of this unpopularity stems from the attitude that the United States took during that period, that it was Pakistan that wasn't doing enough, even though from a Pakistani perspective, Pakistan was suffering enormously from this war in terms of internal events, terrorist activity that had targeted Pakistani people, in terms of very significant long-term sacrifices with respect to Afghan refugees, and so forth and so on. So there was a great deal of irritation, and then of course there's the issue of the use of the unmanned armed vehicles, the drones, which have targeted Pakistan, which also are deeply unpopular in Pakistan.
The one reason that there's that this region gets our attention, maybe not the attention that it should, but one region, is that there has been this longstanding sort of Cold War going on between India and Pakistan. And the level of concern got seriously ratcheted up a few years back when both of these countries became nuclear powers. So we're very concerned about the possibility of conflict and that could potentially escalate to that level. And it certainly does indeed seem to be something that concerns the Indians, the Pakistanis. And, you know, from time to time we get these reports about these little attempts to reach over. And, you know, a couple of people may meet, they may talk. Then maybe something comes along and happens that knocks it back a few more steps. So they seem to take one step forward and two back. But there continue to be these contacts. In fact, one thing that's just been in the news recently, there's a summit meeting coming up, apparently, the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation. And there's now talk that the prime ministers of India and Pakistan are going to meet. When they're there for this meeting, they're going to get together. So there are these little tentative attempts to improve this relation. Where does that stand now? And can you say that over the last few years, there's been any progress at all in easing tensions between the two countries?
There certainly has been progress if you look at this in the long term. But when steps are taken in the direction of normalizing or approaching normalization of relationships between the two states, and specifically with regards to the Kashmir issue, they've been foiled by events, or spoiled, you might say. I think the closest Pakistan and India came to normalizing relations, or at least dealing significantly with Kashmir, came prior to the Kargil operation, this war that was prompted by Pakistan's incursion across the line of control, which resulted in a true war between India and Pakistan. After that, the two states, which were coming closer together, were pushed apart, and there's been it's been hard to come back from that. There have been numerous attempts to try to normalize relations between the two states. It's in the interest of both states to normalize relations. I think most a large segment of both Pakistani and Indian public opinion would favor that. And certainly that would be the case with regards to many of the elites in both societies. But again, there's incidents that spoil this. And the Mumbai incident, which occurred, is one such incident. So the process of trying to move towards a changed relationship between India is a difficult one, and it's a fragile one, and it can be easily upset. So, given that, it's very unlikely, in my view, that that it will proceed in the context of the ongoing war with Afghanistan, because there's too many spoilers that would not like to see this happen on both sides of the border. That could provoke one or the other side to pull away from any kind of accommodation, so I think that's the unfortunate situation.
Yeah. Well, just very quickly, and I have some callers that we get to. It's hazardous to try to predict the future, but if we were having this conversation 5 years from now or 10 years from now, do you think things essentially would be unchanged in the India-Pakistan relationship?
It's always safest to say that things will go in the same direction if one's to predict the future, you know, more of the same. Yeah. So if I was to assign a probability, I would think that's the most likely outcome, is that you'll have more of the same. There is some possibility. There's certainly interest and goodwill on both sides to reach a better accord. There's economic reasons why this would be done. There's certainly issues associated with both states' long-term security interests for this to be resolved. So there certainly will continue to be attempts, both direct governmental and back-channel sorts of attempts to reach some sort of accommodation between the states. But in the context of the continuing war in Afghanistan, which may continue on, it will continue on indefinitely, it seems to me. It seems really unlikely for this to bear fruit.
We have as our guest in this hour of Focus Charles Kennedy. He's a professor of political science at Wake Forest University. That's in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. He's done a lot of writing about South Asian politics, done field research in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India, and has also written about political Islam and U.S. foreign policy with respect to the Middle East and South Asia. He's visiting the campus here. We'll be giving a talk tonight, looking at issues of security, stability, and peace, both in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And this is tonight, 7 o'clock, at the Levis Center on the campus. Anybody who is interested should feel welcome to attend. Questions here are welcome, too, and we have several. We'll take them in the order that they came in. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a couple of Urbana people here to start off with. We'll start with line one. Right here. Hello. Caller there, line one in Urbana. Line one, go ahead.
Okay. I have two questions regarding nuclear issues, one fairly broad and the other more specific. Mm-hmm. With respect to the security of Pakistani nuclear weapons, how much concern do you have on a scale of 1 to 10, that's kind of hard to kind of globalize, but if you break it down, you can think of about three different ways in which it could occur: an Indo-Pakistan war, for one, a Taliban takeover, for another, Pakistani compliance or at least involvement with proliferation, as has occurred in the past, or simply, theft. The other part of that is the extent to which there are major concerns about Pakistani security of nuclear weapons. What has been done from the U.S. perspective or U.S. involvement in trying to enhance security? The second one deals with the U.S.-India nuclear relationship, which is supposedly totally in the civilian non-military use. But there must have been some assurances to Pakistan from the U.S. part about where the lines would be about not stepping over into things that could upset the military balance. And I was wondering if you could address those two sets of problems. Thank you.
All right.
First, let me say that I'm not an expert on nuclear weapons in general, but I'll address this more from a political perspective in both questions. The first question had to do with security of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, and you mentioned threats having to do with war. It seems to me that of the you said war, the Taliban theft, and you didn't mention it, but accident, it would be another, I think, that would come to mind. I think in terms of these four threats, war is to me the most problematic. During the Mumbai event, which was, if you look at this from a distance, was a relatively minor event. 10 insurgents were involved with relatively rudimentary capabilities, and with debatable ties with respect to Pakistan, and very tenuous ties with respect to Pakistan's government, if any. But that provocation resulted in really quite significant pressure upon the Indian government to take some action against Pakistan. Now, Manmohan Singh resisted this, and the Indian government resisted this. But if there was another incident of a similar nature, or perhaps a more serious nature, one that may target institutions of the state, it would be almost certain that India would have to respond in some manner militarily for because of domestic pressure. Now, if that happened, then it's all bets are off in terms of an issue of war between the two states. Now, whether this would reach the level of nuclear war is quite problematic, but both states are quite averse to using nuclear weapons. And despite numerous journalistic accounts of the weapons being unguarded or less than secure and so forth, both states have significant security with respect to their weapons. So issues of this being problematized by theft or the Taliban, I think is exaggerated. I think there's a very, very low probability of that being an issue. The fourth issue, which I raise, is the question of accident. That's always there with respect to nuclear weapons. You can't dismiss the possibility of this or misreading of signals. So this is problematic, no doubt. Now, in terms of a scale of 1 to 10, if 1 is the lowest and 10 is the highest, I would say war between India and Pakistan based on any sort of several types of scenarios might be in the neighborhood of 2 or 3. With respect to the other issues, Taliban or insurgency, theft or accident, I would say it's more on the scale of 1. You can't really dismiss the threat, of course, but it's generally speaking, I think the threat is relatively low. But one, of course, has to be risk averse when it comes to issues of the exchange of nuclear weapons, no doubt. The issue of the second issue you raise of U.S.-India nuclear relationship and the supply of and change of status, supply of fuel and the change of status, that issue was taken very hard in Pakistan. There is a distinction made now between India's nuclear weapons program or India's nuclear program in general and Pakistan's nuclear program. I am not privy to specific assurances that the United States may have given the Pakistan military to say that this really had was not to be alarmed, that Pakistan should not be alarmed by this development. But I would assume that such assurances were were almost certainly given.
I want to thank the caller. I've got others, and they've been patient. Very quickly, maybe we can come back to this. Is there some possibility, do you think, that that the fact that we've, in a sense, come to this accommodation with India, and that we're willing to support their peaceful use of nuclear energy and kind of we're not really happy about it but sort of live with the idea that they're a nuclear power, that we're going to have to come to that kind of accommodation with Pakistan as well about their nuclear weapons?
Yes, I think it's inevitable that the United States is going to have to recognize that Pakistan is indeed a nuclear weapon state and to regularize that in some manner, particularly in the context of the regularization of this for India. I think that's going to be a hard sell in the United States, but it could act as leverage with regards to the Pakistan government, and certainly something that Pakistan would seek.
All right, let's go to another Urbana caller, line two. Hello.
Hello, I have three different points to talk about. First of all, I find it puzzling, let me say, to characterize Kargil and Mumbai as incidents, considering that an incident of 9/11 led to two wars. So these are not small incidents as far as India goes. The second thing is you mentioned that ISI is a part of the military and not an independent entity. It poses a more serious problem because it becomes part of the government's control much more directly, and you have to assume that when ISI does something or is suspected of doing something, that it has the official military backing or at least looking the other way. And that seems to be the case if you read the Newsweek report this week, saying that thousands of fighters are crossing by night across Pakistan into Afghanistan to counter the surge that has been ordered by the United States, which indicates to me that this talk about Pakistan being proactive is to be discounted quite significantly, if not bunked altogether. I'd like to hear you comment on that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for those questions. And let me first of all address the question with regards to Kargil and Mumbai. But my use of the term incident was not meant to minimize their significance. I do think both of these events were quite significant. Kargil was far more significant in terms of a statal type of interaction than Mumbai. Mumbai, as I believe, was at best or at most tangentially related to statal interests of Pakistan. It was related, it's been largely demonstrated that it was the work of the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is not a government entity in the traditional sense of the term, and or even in the untraditional sense of the term. So I think, but again, there's differences of opinion, and I think the views in Pakistan with respect to these issues are significantly different than the views in India, particularly with regards to Mumbai. With regards to the ISI, this is an issue that has of course been much in the news. Its role in its alleged nefarious role in a whole lot of things within Pakistan and within the region in general. I think one point is that I would be certain of is that the effects of the ISI are exaggerated, perhaps greatly exaggerated. If everything that was attributed to the ISI was true, then the ISI would be one of the most efficient organizations in the world, perhaps the most efficient organization in the world. In Pakistan, of course, the RAW is given similar sorts of treatment as being ultimately involved in various events within Pakistan and Balochistan and so forth. So with that general statement, the ISI, your statement is correct that the ISI is closely identified with the military. I think more with the military now than it was in the past, and the ISI's involvement with groups that are now considered rightly as non-statal insurgencies like Lashkar-e-Taiba was indeed is proven. There was indeed involvement with the ISI and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Now, whether this continues, I think, is far more problematic. There may be sharing of information between the two, but in terms of direct support, I think there's very little evidence that this has prevailed past the Soviet war. I think those are the issues that you raised. There may be others. If I shortchange you, let me know.
All right, let's go to another call here, Champaign County, line 3.
Hi, I'm a little distressed that you're not more critical of the U.S. flaunting of the NPT vis-a-vis so-called civilian nuclear support to India. It just seems that if there's anything that's accelerating and exacerbating the tension, it's there. There are other little things that the U.S. and does, like use some of these groups to destabilize Iran and Baluchistan that never get any comment either. I think the U.S. role in the region has been extremely pernicious from the Reagan days when we were winking at their nuclear, the Pakistani nuclear program. So it's kind of distressing. I was formulating a question more about what I've been hearing from two authors that I've read, Pakistanis, Ahmed Rashid and Tariq Ali. They come at it from very different perspectives, but they're both very, very concerned about the stability of the Pakistani army if the continuation of this strategy of a military solution and eschewing a grand bargain, which even Burnett Rubin co-authored with Ahmed Rashid, a call for some kind of grand bargain in the whole region. I'm not talking about dealing with Hakmatyar or something like that. But there are just so many intricacies of the situation that one can stumble on. But just as a passing note, the border, you said, was never accepted by Pashtuns on both sides of the border. According to Ali, it was also had one of these 100-year colonial time limits on it, too, just like Hong Kong went back to the Chinese, that it was only seen as an interim, though rather long-term, I guess, in colonial sort of perspective of trying to stabilize the warfare of that time. So it's very very little time left to but maybe you should perhaps start with your opinion about the nuclear programs.
I didn't mean to characterize the United States' changing of its policy with India as trivial, nor did I voice any support for this. I think it was a mistake. I think it exacerbated relations between India and Pakistan, and of course, I think deeply weakens the NPT. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. So I think the other issues are very complex, and perhaps at a later time or week we can talk about that.
Well, you want to call or you want to follow up?
Time is short, I guess. I don't think I'll be making it to your talk tonight, but I hope some of these issues are discussed in academia, because it just seems that this superficiality of a lot of analysis is is distressing when so much is really at stake. I just wanted to actually say Marvin Weinbaum spoke at the local mosque and said that one of the few things that he could see in the long term that could do something to stabilize the situation is land reform. I was really surprised to hear that from him in Pakistan. And the indicators, social indicators, I mean, something like, it's hard to get a handle on this, but nearly half of the children in Pakistan are growing up in what can only be called, I can't think of a better word, stunted, because of chronic malnutrition and chronic sorts of diseases and preventable diseases, et cetera, et cetera. So many billions for weaponry and so little for really authentic development that's not tied to a military goal. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, the Marvin's comments with respect to the dire developmental issues within Afghanistan are well, of course, they're correct, and I think that has a very strong effect upon any kind of consideration of a just and long lasting solution to Afghanistan. I'm skeptical about the issue that land reform would be the avenue that would cure everything. I've heard Marvin say this before in other contexts, and it's not. There's a multitude of problems that would prevent significant change in the issue of the level of development within Afghanistan and for that matter within many parts of Pakistan and South Asia in general.
We have 3-4 minutes left. I'm interested in having you talk about the government, the current government of Mr. Zardari, a man who seems to me kind of an accidental president. If it had not been for the assassination of his wife, Benazir Bhutto, I doubt very seriously whether this man had ever been president of Pakistan. He's received a lot of criticism and seems to have been fairly bruised lately in the rough and tumble of Pakistani politics. What can you say about him and the stability of his government?
Well, let me address this in a different way, if I could. It's absolutely right that Zardari was an accidental president, and you're absolutely right that Zardari was sort of the last person one would imagine to be the president of Pakistan, or for that matter, anywhere. So that's well taken, and I think you might make an argument. I would make an argument that his tenure has been perhaps accidentally successful. Recently, Pakistan adopted the 18th Constitutional Amendment, which, among other things, reduced the power of the president to dissolve the National Assembly, abolishing Article 58-2B. This was a very, very significant political development within Pakistan. This is something that has been at the center of issues of politics in Pakistan since 58-2P was established by Zia-ul-Haq. And it was done in a way that which weakened Zardari's power, because the power was taken away from Zardari as president. Now, it's hard to imagine that this would have been done so deftly if it hadn't been for the fact that Zardari had such low popularity. So in this sense, I think this worked out, and also if you look at the Zardari period, there have been significant changes with regards to the United States. I think the policy of the United States has become more Pakistan friendly during this period of time. I think that the days of blaming Pakistan for all of the unrest within the region, as opposed to the share that they perhaps should be blamed for, has gone by. I think the relationship between Pakistan and the United States has really become much more user-friendly. And I think in part that's, again, because of the relative weakness of the Zardari presidency. So not only is an accidental president, but I think you could argue that there has been an accidental benefit from his presidency as well, a very significant benefit for the politics of the state.
Where then, though, does the power in Pakistan lie?
Well, it lies with respect to foreign policy, with respect to security policy. It lies very much in the hands of the military. The military is the makes policy for all intents and purposes with respect to those realms. Domestic policy within Pakistan is contentious. The legislature within Pakistan has been anything but successful over the years in affecting public policy. There are numerous problems within the state associated with this. The judiciary has played a very significant role recently in pushing and prodding the political system to become more they would say more democratic and countering the excesses of the Musharraf period.
I think that's very interesting. We really don't have a lot of time. I think that's very interesting because if you look back at the forces that were at work that pushed Mr. Musharraf from office, very clearly an important thing here was this conflict between Pervez Musharraf and Iftikhar Chaudhry, who was the Chief Justice of Pakistan's Supreme Court. He's still going head-to-head with the government because that conflict, that Musharraf-Chaudhry conflict, became a Zardari-Chaudhry conflict.
Well, it's certainly the case that that Zardari is in the crosshairs of Justice Chaudhry at the moment, yes. and I think that ultimately, Zardari is a remarkable man, no doubt, and if anyone can get out of the crosshairs, it would be him. but it seems to me that it's very likely that Zardari will eventually have to leave his position.
You want to say when?
No, I wouldn't predict that. I think sooner rather than later, though, if I was to make a prediction, within 6 months, if I had to.
Indeed. All right. Well, there we'll leave it with, again, the mention that our guest, Charles Kennedy, who teaches at Wake Forest University and writes a lot about South Asian politics, is here visiting the campus and will be talking about all of these issues, I'm sure, and more as a part of a talk tonight. And it's happening at 7 o'clock at the Levis Center on the campus. It's free, open to the public, sponsored jointly by the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security, Project Noor, a student-led initiative of the American Islamic Congress and also the Pakistani Graduate Students Association. And I'm sure all of them would welcome you to the talk tonight and say anybody who would like to stop by should feel welcome. And to Charles Kennedy, we say thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
And that's it for us here this morning on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. More coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Gwynn.
Thank you very much, David. Good morning. It's 2 minutes before noon. This is WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. In Kansas City, the May wheat contract is at 508, up 16 and a half. July 516, up 14. Chicago May wheat, 492, up 15 and three quarters. July 503 and three quarters, up 15 and three quarters. May corn, 364 and a half, up 7 and a half. July 372 and three quarters, up 8 and three quarters. September 379 and a half, up 8 and a half. December 386 and a half, up 8 and three quarters. May beans, 989, up 6 and a quarter. July 999 and a half, up 6. August 998, up 6 and three quarters. September 982 and a half, up 6 and a half. November 973, up 7 and a half. May soybean meal, 288 even, that's down 60. May oil, 3885, up 31. April live cattle, 98.65, up 60. June, 93.77.5, up 35. April feeder cattle, 113.52.5, up 25. May, 112.67.5, up 37.5. May lean hogs, 87.75. That is down 45. June crude, 85.06, up 184. The U.S. dollar, 82. That is down 38. The CRB index, 275.58, up 107. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 143 points at 11,188. The NASDAQ up 35 at 25.07. The S&P 500 up 6.